one thing that really has fascinated me is that these things are quite real, this business of the plant and the soil interaction, and which means clay mineralogy, basically. And so that, in fact, we can trace this effect throughout the time of agricultural man. And a thing that I just realized yesterday, in fact, talking to people here with the posters and so forth, it seems that most of the people in the North American continent, at any event, in a large part, around in this part of the world, Neolithic really means Amerindian or native peoples who were here before we messed things up. So these people had very old cultures, Neolithic revolution, so forth and so on. But the conditions were quite different because the climate was different and the plants that were available was different. So what I would like to talk about is the Neolithic revolution in Europe, the Middle East, which in fact turns out to be probably a little bit, or in fact, much more different from the other areas where the Neolithic revolution occurred. And I will explain why, I hope. The Neolithic revolution was really an extraordinary thing. A number of technological advances occurred almost simultaneously. Simultaneously is about within 1,000 years, or maybe two. You know, but anyway, it was pretty far away in the past. So a number of things happened, and man put together or developed a number of tools that really transformed society. One was, of course, crop growing, that is, he selected plants. And in the Middle East, there were grain crops and lentils. It's not an innocent thing. It's a legume. And these things were grown from the beginning on. You do crop rotation. Animal husbandry occurred at the same time. And particularly in the Middle East, which is an extremely important factor, it was sheep and goats to a large extent. Cows were still running around in the prairies, and pigs weren't used too much. In fact, now they aren't at all. Also, pottery was developed. That is, impermeable, heat-resistant objects could be used for cooking. And we know that if you transform food by cooking, you increase the nutritive value by a factor of 2 to 3. And another one that was extremely important, it seems simple-minded, but for about 1 million or more years before the Neolithic, man was banging on rocks and making sharp edges with them. But in order to do that, you need a rock that's going to shatter so you can make a sharp edge. And their initial use was to cut, and was to butcher meat, cut off skin, this kind of stuff. But you can't use that kind of a tool as a percussion instrument to cut down trees or things like that. You need a hard, fine-grained rock that doesn't fracture. And those can be used but by polishing and making a polished axe head. And this came about at this time, all over the world, in fact. So all of these things were coming together roughly at the same time. And the guy, everything was there, and you could spread this around. But really no big reason to do it, except that at the Neolithic period, about 8,000 before our era, the climate changed. So at that time, man was a little bit less pretentious than today. It wasn't his fault. Man couldn't change the climate. We're not going to do that kind of stuff. So the only thing could have been God. So God changed the climate because it's a catastrophic event. People were in the Tigris-Euphrates area or along the Palestinian coast and up on the hills. The climate was great. There were trees that gave fruit. You had anything you needed was there. You just had to go out and pick it off the tree. So this has been described, as a matter of fact, in the Bible. So God created Adam and Eve. They were in Eden. And then something went wrong, climate change. So since men were writing the book, but God couldn't do it, who can we blame it on? It was a woman, of course. What else? It's Eve. She's got the system into disequilibrium, and then they got kicked out of Eden. So anyway, they had to move from that place. And this was described in the Bible. So in order for this to happen, we had to change what was going on in the place where you were. Now, this seems like an old story, and in fact, the second part of it is that when they had to leave, they went into the Neolithic period, and so you had herders and you had agricultural people. And the herders were Abel, and the agricultural people were Cain. They were progressives. They were using crop science and this kind of thing. And they gave their offerings to God, who was a bit conservative, as we know sometimes. And God chose a fatted sheep as being his favorite. And this got the agricultural guy, Cain, all upset. And so he killed his brother. And then they had to move. Then the whole thing got out of hand. So that's another old story. But I do in particular. Maybe some of you don't so much. You remember these cowboy movies we used to watch? John Wayne and all that stuff? John Wayne was out there herding and sleeping with the guys out and so on and so on. And his enemy, in fact, was the person who was a sod buster, the agricultural people. And so the same antagonism occurred when we colonized the west of the United States, just repeating a Bronze Age story. So what happened, actually, the resistance to this process is related in Genesis chapter 4. But given that the climate changed into a more dry climate and a bit hotter, but further north, not too far away, actually, the climate became boreal, where it was cooler and there was more rain, but this, in fact, favored trees. So the basic structure of the ecology where the Neolithic was created first in the Middle East was that of grasslands. They domesticated grassland plants. They got the sheep and the goats out of the mountains, but their base was down in areas where they could grow grasslands in a normal grassland soil. This being the case, they had to move out. They couldn't use this natural resource because it was no longer fertile. And the obvious place to go was to the north into the woodlands, because it rained more, there was more of rain availability to grow crops, and this was the obvious move. But the problem is that forests create soils that are antithetic to prairie plants. Forests have roughly poor soil texture, not too much water retention. They have a clay poor E horizon. Clays are accumulated here, but one of the most important things is that vermiculite is present, and there's a high aluminum content in the soil solutions. Now, this is very bad for prairie plants, wheat, all this sort of thing. Aluminum is very bad. High pH is not good. They don't grow very well. So there's an antagonism, basically, between these two types of soil structures. Here we have a fairly thick zone of organic-rich material, which maintains good aggregates, which sequester water and put it in a reserve for periods of drier areas. Whereas here, this isn't so important for forests, because their root system, to a large extent, can tap much more deeply, so forth and so on. So that if Neolithic man was to move into the forest area, he had to transform the soil structure, the soil chemistry, and the soil mineralogy. This is productivity of corn, wheat, and oats as a function of pH, which basically determines the amount of aluminum soluble in the solutions. And here we see that low pHs, the productivity drops off really a lot. And so you want to be in this area, and you want to change the pH in the soil structure. So here we're back to the sandwiches. And what Neolithic man had to do was get out the hydroxy AL and put in some potassium. So how are you going to do that? Well, the process was spread across Europe in a rather slow rate. This is the the fertile Quassant area, the crescent, the Tigris-Euphrates area, the Palestinian coast. And men at the Neolithic period, about 8,000 BC, started to move out. And the Neolithic process of agriculture and stable communities moved up at that time. Where are we? Yep. Moved up this way and also this way. And the rate of change, that is, the introduction, was roughly 1 kilometer a year. So this was not an invasive process where you guys are running in and kicking everybody out. It was a basically a technological transfer. But the archaeologists have a lot of problems with how it happened. That is, you get a new culture coming in because the previous one were hunter-gatherers. It was John Wayne going out chasing the cows in the forest and this kind of stuff. And then somebody comes in and they say, okay, well, yeah, what we want to do is just to grow the crops around our place and then stay where we are. And again, I think the major driving force behind this was women. Because they'd learn how to make pottery. They'd learn how to make complicated woven baskets and cloth and all this kind of stuff. And every 5 or 6 years, you got to put all that stuff on a couple of poles and drag it across, and it's going to get broken, and everything's going to get messed up. No woman wants to move every 4 or 5 years. So they say, no, you stay here. Why don't you raise crops, and we'll have a nice, stable life, I think. Anyway, so one of the critical steps was to cut down the trees. Now, there are two ways to get rid of trees in the northern United States. That's not too bad. Both were used, but actually in the Northeast, one of the major methods was girdling. You just took off the bark, the tree died, and it was left standing. But that doesn't use any of the mineral potentials in the wood itself. It's much, much better, in fact, to cut down the tree with these smooth stones like this, which can cut down trees, but also can be used as agricultural tools to break the crusted, dried soils when they're clay rich. These can be used to get rid of the trees and to cultivate the soil. So, and then the other coincidence was that these people had goat and sheep. Now, this isn't so important for Americans, but where I come from, that means cheese. And cheese is an interesting thing because it's a good source of protein. It can be stored and it can be transported without problems. And as far as archaeologists in the Middle East know, the use of animals to make cheese, in fact, was quite plenty contemporaneous with the domestication of these two animals. So probably cheese making was relatively important. And these are examples of pots that you can use to drain out the water, get the thing to coagulate, and then you just dry the materials, become stable chemically, and you can conserve it for fairly long periods of time. So, cut down the trees, you burn them to get the potassium out, but also at the same time you're changing the pH because you have KOH but CaO also. So the pH is changing, you're changing the chemistry, it stabilizes the vermiculites. And you're adding potassium in to fill in the aluminum that's going to be released. Then you get rid of the trees, and this gives you a certain time when you can cultivate this land. Roughly slash and burn, which is just a minimal process, gives you about a 7 to 8 year period of fertility. And then the effect of pH change, potassium at the surface, peters out to a large extent, and you have to move on and cut and burn in another area. And again, you know, this, you got to move your stuff. Your pots are going to get broken and all that kind of stuff. We don't want to do that. So you have goats and sheep, and you're going to milk them. But you don't want to let them go too far away. because you ain't gonna run around the forest looking for one or two sheep, and then where are you gonna put the milk and all this kind of stuff? So you build a pen. So you stable them and stabilize around the community, and in doing so, you have a source of manure. And this manure, of course, is the most powerful regenerating agent that we know of, particularly if it's mixed with straw. Raw manure isn't so great, but when it's mixed with straw, you can maintain the fertility for 6-7 years or something like that. If you use just raw manure, it's 1 or 2 years. But in fact, the manure piles was in France, in any event, in Germany, other places, 19th century, there were books written on how to take care of your manure pile. You have to water it, and you have to add just enough. You have to take out at the right time when it's ripe, because there's a bacteriological process that transforms the straw and the raw manure and makes a very powerful agent for fertility. So at the same time, they were cutting down the trees, stabilized the animals around their areas where they were living, and they could use this manure in their fields around the villages, around the areas where they were dwelling. And at the same time, from the original domestication processes, they had grain crops, wheat, but they also had lentils. So you have legumes that can increase the nitrogen content, potassium most likely also. So they had all of the tools, basically, of classical agriculture as it was practiced for a long time. So the basic problem to overcome was getting rid of vermiculite, and hydroxychlorite materials, transforming that into a prairie-type soil, and maintaining the prairies. And in fact, in order to do that, there was about a 10-15 year period when the area was left in prairie, the animals would feed on it, and this is where the regeneration process occurred. So about a third of the time you were raising crops, and two-thirds of the time you were regenerating the soil with animals grazing and so forth and so on. So this is the sequence, Bronze Age, we don't have any older, of what people were doing out around these villages. And you have two cows, a stick of wood, a sharp edge, and a guy that's running around after it. The Roman period, you have two cows, a stick with a sharp edge, and a guy that's running around after it. And here's somebody that's laughing at him. And 19th century is the same thing. So basically, if we consider the activity and the structure of agriculture in Europe, in any event, it was extremely constant, and it remained the same pattern for 5,000 years or something of that order of magnitude. And as we saw in the, whoever was here, in the classical agriculture in the polar areas. When I first went to France, I'm from the Midwest, and so everybody's talking about wearing out the soils. And we know that happened on the East Coast, because in the beginning of the colonization, people had large estates, Washington, Jefferson, all this kind of stuff. They had hundreds and hundreds of acres. You go back there now, and there's a couple of corn patches, and the rest of it's in forest. It's been that way a long time. So the basic structure of American agriculture was not conservative. But when I went to France, these guys were doing their thing, and I said, how long have you been doing this? And I looked it up, and he said, 4,000 years, how can it be fertile? And in fact, with a labor-intensive system, the productivity per surface area at that time in the 60s and 70s in France, the productivity per area was greater than that in the United States, because it was labor-intensive, but they were using, to a large extent, natural fertilizers and so forth and so on and so forth. But thousands of years, and then the internal combustion engine came, and we created tractors. So one of the major things is that there was a switch of energy source from grains and plants to captured carbon resources. These guys here, depending on when, were using up 20 to 30% of the products of the surface as food, particularly if you shortened the prairie cycle, which was done by using clover and alfalfa and these kind of things. Still, a lot of the product was used for these animals. Then we didn't need it anymore. We just bought it. And so that freed up the land, but you didn't have the natural fertilization processes. And so we got some other ideas. So this is the productivity, roughly speaking, as far as we know it, over time in France. This data is from France because it's easier for me to get it, but it's basically the same for much of Europe. So here we're going along, it's getting a little bit better, so forth and so on, developing species and so forth and so on, and then suddenly, wow, goes way up. You could say, well, it's probably because of fertilizer, so forth. But the use of potash and then of phosphates and then of potash was known in the 19th century. But since it was relatively expensive, people didn't use it very much. So it didn't really change the productivity enormously. And we still see here in the 50s and so forth, the thing really shot up. So what was it about? It was ammonium. The guys that make vermiculite in the soils and soil chlorides. So here, it's going along and suddenly, whoom! And at the same time, of course, it goes together with tractor production, populations, that is the use of the tractors. And as a corollary, which we know in the United States very, very well, the more tractor use you have, you get a lot of areas out of production because there's slopes and this kind of stuff, and it isn't as useful, and something drains off and so forth and so on. So basically, we're increasing the productivity enormously with ammonium input, and we're decreasing the surface areas that are farmed. This is the structure, in fact, that we are in at the moment. But we know also that the more ammonium you put in, the plants grow much, much more vigorously, but also they're much more liable to attack by bugs and animals and diseases. So the phytosanitary agents have to be added to a greater extent as you're increasing the productivity. So the two things go together. You have three things. Tractors, they allow you to use to farm bigger surface areas. You can get the productivity up by using chemical processes, but at the same time you need to use chemical agents to control things. So for the question of France, you can say, well, okay, you know, but in fact, at this time too, we had a big increase in the population. So this increase in productivity was in fact very useful and very timely. The post-war period, particularly in different areas of Europe, the population increased, and so we needed this increase in food production. But then it goes up like this, and it sort of gets out of hand. And as it turns out now, the great majority of the crops that are grown in France, as well as the United States, are used to feed animals. And it's not keeping people from starving, but it's keeping the pigs and the cows from starving, so we get beef and that kind of stuff. So basically, what we would like to propose is that it's possible to go back to a certain extent to using the traditional plant soil methods and fertilizer, natural fertilizers to a large extent. Problem we have now is that all the cows are here, the wheat's there, and the pigs are there, and we have a lot of trouble shipping this stuff back and forth. When raw manure is used, it doesn't last very long. It has a lot of contamination problems. It's too intense, as a matter of fact, so forth and so on. So if we could redistribute it, get these things back into a coherent structure similar to what we had before, we could get a reasonable productivity and, in fact, keep the populations alive. Now, I firmly believe that we cannot go back to the productivity levels of the past. We have to get better at it. And the only way is to get the match between plants and soil clays better, use them more efficiently, so that for different fields, for different areas, for different bedrocks, we can match the plants that are used, we can match the the mycorrhizae that are used in different plants, and up the productivity so that we'll get to a level that's acceptable. We won't get probably to the ammonium saturation level, but still, we can get up to a level that's decent. And at least for a portion of the population that wishes to have organic food, we can satisfy this demand, which is growing. This is the crusade.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions for Bruce? I had one real quick. I was curious, plants that can promote illite formation. Is there anything out there which plants are better at promoting
illite
formation?
One thing that I looked at is alfalfa. We know that alfalfa produces nitrogen in these nodules that are bacterial interactions. But I looked at the soils in a former Chinese student in China, and in fact, the alfalfa creates illite over time. The ammonium in the soil doesn't change an awful lot, it's better, but it stocks potassium, curious illite. So that a big part of the fertility of this alfalfa is you rotate the crop. I think it's ammonium, but also potassium. And there are undoubtedly other plants. But nobody's really looked a lot at it.
Yeah. I came in a little late, but I was just wondering.
Yeah, well, things have...
Could you speak in the microphone, Bruce?
Oh, sorry, yeah.
The present day cornfield is so dense
yeah.
that you couldn't see from the
hill. No, for sure. No. There's no question. A lot has to be changed. But the thing is that the present day cornfield is extremely dense because we put enough material in to allow this biomass to grow enormously. But you have to buy that stuff, you know. So if you decrease your money input, the density is lower. But still, you could make out probably. Now, was on TV not very long ago in France. People are starting to go to a biologically grown that is non-chemical methods of farming, and the fellow said that I get paid 40% more for what I sell, and the difference between my productivity loss and that 40% is such that I make a little bit more money than I did before. At least I make out as well as before. So if we can increase the efficiency of this interaction, we can probably make out for a farmer. Now, we have a lot of land that isn't farmed because of the methods we were doing, but it was farmed in the past. In France, the surface area that has been taken out of farming practice is about 20-30%. Now, if you go across Ohio now, and you go, oh, you are, and you go back up across across the mountains, there are enormous areas that used to be farmed. You have a lot of these sort of scrub areas and things like that that have been taken out of culture because these eight-row tractors, this kind of stuff, is not efficient on it. And if you really go far back to where old Tom Jefferson was and George Washington, nobody's farming that much at all, the woodlands areas. But it's true that per surface area, you won't produce as much. This is true.
Question.
Yeah. Well, it's not really illite. We don't have. Well, it's difficult to know. Well, but yeah. So my student looked at aggregates in one of these experimental fields, and so he separated them out water soluble by their size, and he looked at the clay mineralogy by size of the aggregates. And the bigger aggregates contain 2-to-1 minerals. You get down to the smaller ones and you're getting more and more kaolinite. So the 2-to-1 minerals are interacting with the organic matter much more, creating the bigger aggregates, but the aggregate density is roughly the same, I assume. But it's just creating more micropore space so that you have a bigger water reserve. And this is what classically we know, that if you don't have enough organic matter in the soil, you don't have good soil structure. But also it can be dependent upon the clay mineralogy.
Mm-hmm. So, could you test your ideas by comparing modern soils and clay mineralogy to buried surface horizons? Paleosols and clay mineralogy there?
To a certain extent, yes. The case in Europe and in the United States is that almost all of the tills and almost all of the loess areas are illite-smectite dominated. And this means that the original materials, chlorite and mica, have been transformed by plant interaction already, and probably even before they were deposited as till. But there's another situation where the effect of plants can be tested more directly, and that's in places like China, and curious enough, in the Po Valley in Italy, where the loess is still coming down, and we're getting the interactions, getting the transformations of the basic clay minerals and seeing which ones stay and which ones don't. But the paleosols, you could look to see in the climatic fluctuations, if there were forest or not forest present at that time, we could look to see if the clays were different. But actually, at the moment, if you look at the present structure, we know roughly where the most recent biotope was forest and prairie across the Midwest. It goes down the Illinois state line and Indiana, all kind of stuff. If you go over in Indiana, there's a lot more vermiculite than if you go up where I'm from. Yeah. So that's even remaining to a certain extent in the soils after hundreds of years of culture. Yes, sir.
Reference to the structure. I don't know if this relates or not, but in our work with acetose adsorption, which is a small ion, small molecule that moves in between the layers of smectite, as the charge goes up in smectite, among smectites, the ones that are nearer to vermiculite and charge are very poor.
Oh, it's sure. That's really interesting. And there are some smectites are more equal than others. No, that's really an interesting thing, because that being the case, then the illite smectites, or the smectites that have higher charge, would be more efficient at capturing potassium, whereas the other ones of lower charge would be more efficient in making this, making the aggregates and fixing the organic material. So you could have sort of two functions in the same kind of materials that are present, and the balance could very well determine something about the soil structure and the potassium retention. That's really interesting. Is it published? Do we have stuff that you could send me?
We have a couple of papers that are now in journal review.
Great. That would be wonderful if you could do that. That's really an interesting thing. Really an interesting thing.
Thanks for your participation. We have a 10-minute break, and we'll meet for our next speaker. So let's thank Bruce again.